That's what Thales is especially known for. There's a couple other anecdotes in the fragments as well.
Thales is perhaps the first recorded thinker who really introduces three fundamental aspects of philosophy, particularly the study of metaphysics, particularly the study of what we might call ontology, the study of being. He's looking for one fundamental explanation for the universe. So this becomes like a consistent theme throughout philosophy, that there's got to be, at bottom, there's got to be one substance. It's got to be one consistent substance that makes up the world. An example that probably sounds more familiar to our modern listeners is there was an ancient school of philosophers much later on, but still in ancient Greece, called the atomists, who believed that the world was made up. The fundamental substance was tiny, tiny little invisible particles that made up the world. Strangely accurate to what we scientifically have like kind of come to understand today, but it was quite impressive that they were able to think about it. But again, that's another example of someone saying, okay, there's got to be a fundamental substance of the earth. How about tiny little particles? Thales was one of the first guys to do that, if not the first. He picked water. We kind of go, just for our listeners, a lot of pre-Socratics, they go through the elements. They love picking out elements for fundamental stuff. But the other one, though, which I think is really interesting, is Thales came up with the idea that whatever is fundamental must be a thing. It must have being. And this becomes a concept that gets picked up more later on by other pre-Socratics. But that there's this, whatever is real, like whatever is the most fundamental thing, must have some kind of reality to it. It must have being, it must have some kind of existence. And that finally, another big one is that whatever is most fundamental must have change. It must be able to shift, to not necessarily physically move, but have that capacity to cause change in itself and change other beings, other entities as well.
Yeah, because what your explanation, so if you have a single explanation for the world, the reason you have a single explanation is because you're trying to explain a plurality of phenomena. And so this single substance or this single explanation has to be able to take different forms. It has to be a changing substance, as you're saying. There's one other small thing that Aristotle does say about him that doesn't really have to do with water, and it's kind of always stumped me. I think the interesting thing for Thales as far as water goes is that he did try to explain various phenomena with a single substance, and in a way where it's not obvious how water is the cause of rocks, and yet you can find some way that water causes rocks. And to tie this in with other explanations of other things, that's kind of the feat of Thales.
And with that feat, kind of again what we've been talking about in terms of why pre-Socratics are important, mm-hmm. It's not so much the content of those arguments in some ways, you might say. Yes. I mean, like the guy kind of being like everything is affected by water, or water is the most important thing. Maybe not really. I don't know how convincing the listeners will find that. But the fact that he's out there making arguments for why his point stands,
yeah,
that is the revolutionary aspect,
yeah,
that people like Thales introduced.
I'm impressed by Thales. I really admire him as a pre-Socratic thinker. But if you explain Thales to like a scientist or someone who's been more scientifically minded, he seems like kind of an idiot. Like it's just obvious the connections he's drawing. But that's to mistake what philosophers find impressive about Thales. It's the form of the reasoning that is occurring here. That's what's interesting.
So should we read a couple of his, a couple more of his fragments? I'm going to go and start off with the one that is many people's favorite. And it might be the first like distracted, absent-minded, head in the clouds philosopher anecdote of all time. This is the OG one, the original. So the fragment goes like this: a witty and attractive Thracian servant girl is said to have mocked Thales for falling into a well while he was observing the stars and gazing upwards, declaring that he was eager to know the things in the sky, but that but that what was behind him and just by his feet escaped his notice. This fragment basically is a story of how a servant girl mocked him because he was so busy staring at the stars and studying the stars and trying to understand the nature of things that he walked into a well because he forgot his everyday surroundings.
I had a professor who told me that apparently Ann Carson quipped that it was at the bottom of that well that Thales discovered that all things are water.
It's an interesting fragment, for sure. It's an interesting little quote. It is that first absent-minded philosopher. There's two things that immediately jump out to me as part of it. With any of these fragments, people have been studying them for so long. There's so much you can get out of them. But two things that really stand out to me are, well, the witty and attractive is an interesting wording for sure of the girl.
There is something that you should know about the Thracians that I was tipped off to by a professor as well. And it's that when Plato is saying that Thales was mocked by a Thracian girl, Thracian here is kind of a Greek idiom for a country bumpkin, you know, a country girl. She's witty, but this is contrary to her typical character. She's witty and attractive, but Thracians are kind of, you know, they're not supposed to be. So I don't know. I just think that it might supply something here if you're making an observation about the person who is kind of making fun of Thales here.
Well, I think the point is observing the stars and gazing upwards for our listeners. Again, so just as another note with Thales, but pretty much all these thinkers, like nobody was sitting around at that time being like, Thales is a philosopher, right? They were also statesmen. They might have been business people. They might have been aristocrats. But they were also very early scientists, by and large. And one of the things that they were most focused on was the stars and astrological charts navigation in relationships to stars and star patterns and all that kind of stuff. And so it's interesting that even this early on, the beginnings of philosophy, there's this connection made between understanding the stars, understanding the sky, and having philosophical insight. That connection is made very early on. And then also, too, this idea that, you know, this kind of, again, metaphor of reference that, like, what philosophers give up or walk away from or are uninterested in is everyday life, is what's, you know, what's directly closest to them, what's most around them, what's around them, what's under their feet. That stuff is what they are walking away from.
Yeah, they're
the physical world.
Yeah, or specifically, I think the multiplicity that, because we already see this with Thales' thought, right? You abandon observing the plurality of the world to look at a single principle. You look at, so the other thing you have to realize too is that for the ancient Greeks, the heavens were considered eternal. The motion of the stars was a divine eternal process. So to be doing something like this was, it wasn't like pious, but it was to be engaged in something not temporal. It was to be engaged in something eternal.
And that goes back to Thales and in the early pre-Socratics, I think their obsession with finding, you know, what is the consistent, eternal, non-temporal substance and being of the universe, right? What is that fundamental stuff that makes everything up? And that the stars, obviously, gazing at the sky is kind of a sort of reference to that process. Thales says the principle is water, for which reason he declared that the earth rests on water, getting the notion perhaps from seeing the nutriment of all things is moist, and that heat itself is generated from the moist and kept alive by it, and from the fact that seeds of all things have a moist nature, and that water is the origin of moist things. So I think that's a great fragment for focusing on. Again, we can discuss whether or not, like, water is the fundamental principle of all things, but it's much more important, I think, to discuss how he's using he's reasoning here, right? That water is the origin of all moist things. That, you know, if anything's going to grow, there's got to be water. The one I always kind of puzzled was that heat itself is generated from the moist and kept alive by it. But what I read from that is that, or how I take that is that there's some sort of noticing that fire consumes things that are wetter than itself.
I don't have that one in the specific translation that you have, but reading from my water field, I do have that. And I'm noticing that this is the Aristotle. This is an Aristotle fragment, right? Or it's an Aristotle testimony, we would call it. So mine says, Thales, who was the founder of this kind of philosophy, says that water is the first principle, which is why he declared that the earth was on water. He perhaps reached this conclusion from seeing that everything's food is moist, and that moisture is the source and prerequisite for the life of warmth itself, and the source of anything is the first principle of that thing. So I think the interesting thing here is that with Aristotle, because Aristotle, I find when he is trying to relate Thales or any other of the pre-Socratics to other pre-Socratics, you find that Aristotle has to introduce ideas, right? So I think that Thales is explaining the plurality of things through a single principle. He's trying to explain how it is that, you know, because I think the plausibility for Thales is that food is moist, but I don't. So Thales yet doesn't have an actual mechanism for explaining how it is that water becomes something yet, though, which Aristotle has to introduce by this idea of changing states, right? So Thales wants to explain that everything is a single arche, it's a single beginning, it's a single principle. But then Aristotle says, and it can transition into these other states, right? Well, if you're Thales and you're a legitimate monist who says that all things are water, things don't change into something else. Water just changes into different forms, right? So this is one case where I think that you see, again, this is me kind of scraping back one of those layers that I think Aristotle might be introducing, this idea that Thales thinks that water can change into something else. Well, Thales thinks that water just becomes something else. It's still water. It's just that water explains that other thing. This is me, I don't know, this is me just trying to be a bit critical of when Aristotle is because Aristotle is a systematizer of the pre-Socratics. He's trying to square these contradictions. It's what he does. You take the eudoxa and you get the best that you can from all of it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you arrive at like an accurate picture of what Thales is saying. So again, this is me kind of playing detective.
I think though that's an excellent point. And kind of talking to like at the beginning of the show, we are always looking at these very early thinkers through the prism of people who came after them, especially the bigger names, people like Aristotle and Plato and such, who had a lot to say at times about them, but also probably at times only had a fragmentary understanding themselves, or were dealing with stuff that was not nearly as systematized or thought out. And like you say, you have later thinkers kind of introducing ideas that really do shift a lot of what the original text would have been.
Yeah, so the other thing that makes me want to look for these kinds of things underneath the surface with Aristotle too is that at the very beginning of his Metaphysics, he says, yeah, there were people who were talking about what I'm going to talk about here, but they didn't really know what they were talking about. He insults them. He calls them baby talkers. He has contempt for the people who came before him doing what he did. So you need to be on guard against his contempt for the people that came before him. And sometimes, you know, he does his best to be as neutral as possible, but he just flat out says, like, these guys didn't know what they were talking about, so I'm going to do the job properly. And if you're going to get to, if you're going to get behind what Aristotle does to these thinkers, you need to be you need to be on your toes.
There's the one that I think is really interesting for the rest of philosophical thought, especially thinking about, we already brought up Aristotle. Thales, too, seems, from what they relate, to have supposed that the soul was something kinetic. If he said that the magnesium stone possesses the soul because it moves iron. On early forms of, you might call it epistemology, you might call it the earliest forms of anthropology, studying the human being, this idea of the soul, the animating force within us, is an active thing. Recognizing that whatever at like sort of activates the human body, whatever makes us as physically happening, thinking being, is some sort of energy or force that is itself active.
Apparently, inanimate things have this, as the case with these magnets, that some things have soul in them, and that explains their movement or their self-movement.
Yeah, that kind of, that generation is, that self-generating power is in all living things. And apparently in some ostensibly non-living things, although maybe Thales would have thought different of certain magnetic rocks and metals and stuff like that.
Yeah,
but, well, that's... Again, really interesting, very early point.
Yeah, I mean, it's just clear
Sorry, go ahead.
If this is the next fragment in your selection, some say that it, soul, is intermingled in the universe, for which reason perhaps Thales also thought that all things are full of gods. So Thales is seeing... So the word there specifically is theon, whereas the word soul is psuche. But Thales does see gods everywhere. I don't know if he sees souls everywhere. I don't know if he believes in a panpsychic animated world soul, but he does see gods everywhere. For which I'm less clear on what the ancient Greek strict conception of the gods were in this sense to be able to try and make sense of what Thales is saying. But he does seem to think that, at least in the previous fragment, that's at least some things also have souls, psuche specifically.
Straying a little bit away from the text for a second and thinking more about the world this came from, this sort of oftentimes what's called a kind of animism, that all things are animated with a soul, was a very, at least from what we know and understand today, archaeologically speaking, anthropologically speaking, was a very common type of pseudo-religious understanding within the world, right? That all things have an animated aspect that makes them what they are and guides them to fulfill their, you know, their life process or their existence process for inanimate objects and stuff like that, right? And then to translate that and ask, okay, well, human beings must have some sort of force clearly then too. Like, what can we understand and know about that? We don't have a huge, I'm thinking for listeners, we don't have a huge amount of time left. Do we want to look a little bit at Anaximander before we go? And then I think we might have to turn this into a multi-part episode. There's too much to say, even with so little fragments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we can introduce Anaximander and get on the table what the kind of principal idea of his, and then maybe we'll go into the next episode.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about who he was, and then we can talk about like the main big principle that makes him the kind of the everything guy.
Biographically, we don't have a ton on Anaximander. Actually, I think we do, but for the purposes of doing pre-Socratic philosophy, all you need to know is that apparently Anaximander was a pupil or a disciple of Thales. So we have, I think one of the things that makes the Miletians really easy to classify is that we apparently have a kind of intellectual lineage. It's one of the first intellectual lineages that we seem to have. Of Thales transmits his ideas to Anaximander, who is then going to translate his own ideas to Anaximenes later on, but we'll get to Anaximenes in the next episode. So Anaximander inherits the project of positing a single arche to explain the cosmos, but he takes a very different turn from Thales, whereas Thales posits one of the classical elements, so earth, wind, water, fire. Thales elects to choose water. Anaximander, it's interesting that I wonder if this is kind of a him anticipating that, okay, well, if I just say, you know, earth, then we just get ourselves wrapped up in these problems of, okay, who's right or wrong. So he chooses another, kind of invents a new idea to explain the cosmos outside of the classical elements. And the word for that element is the apeiron. Now, I give it the Greek because it might as well be Greek. When it gets told in English, so the indefinite, the limitless, or the unlimited, the boundless, it's almost more mysterious. So giving it that technical term almost makes... I find it... When I think about it, I think it's helpful to just think of it as the apeiron. But essentially what the apeiron is the very notion of indefinitude itself. So for example, if you take a line is the distance between two points, right? Now, the space between those two points is limited. It is bounded by those two points, right? If you change where the bounds are, that line changes as well. So the line is the peros, the bounded, right? If you took away those points, or if you say extrapolated the line past those points into infinity, you no longer have a bounds. You no longer have that point. You no longer have the peros. That's what apeiron is. A being the alpha privative, apeiron. So that's how you get the boundless. Now, what does that mean for Anaximander? For Anaximander, essentially he is saying that what structures the cosmos, what explains everything, is a certain indefinitude, that nothing has any kind of clear bounds to it. So when the ocean washes up on the shore, the earth that it crashes up against is not clearly distinct from the water that crashes up against it. And maybe that, you know, kind of circling back, I wonder if that's why Anaximander thought that you couldn't just pick and choose classical elements, because they're all kind of mixed up together. They aren't actually that distinct. They are apeiron. They are boundless. They don't have that essential, they don't have that real distinction that you think they have. Underneath all of it is this governing principle of mixture, of indefinitude. And it is really interesting because the intellectual achievements of Anaximander are quite impressive. So the mind that produces the idea, it's quite abstract, and Anaximenes later on is going to try and respond to the incomprehensible abstractness of this principle. But the idea that Anaximenes posited the idea of the earth, the reason that we don't seem to like fly off the earth, or the reason that the earth seems to be still, is because we're in the center of the universe. It has nowhere to go. That's explained by this principle of apeiron, because it doesn't have any bounds within any kind of space, right? It's just set. Well, it does have bounds in space. It's at the center of it. I mean, I'd have to look into how to square the idea that space is apeiron and yet it has a center. But in any case, he has an interesting explanation for how it is that that the Earth seems to be where it is. It kind of falls into place.
The apeiron is very clearly, you know, a move to the metaphysical that is very significant. There's no appeal to physical substance here in any classic sense, like you said, earth, wind, fire, air kind of thing. Okay, we're going to point at one thing that seems to be the most consistent or the most impactful that we actually encounter. You don't really encounter a paron. Everything is a paron.
Yeah.
And this sort of metaphysical jump is huge within the context of philosophical thinking.
Yeah, I mean, it's really the first attempt to, or it's the first intellectual reaction. Anaximander sees that Thales is explaining everything with the very thing to be explained. And so Anaximander invents a metaphysical principle to try and explain what is kind of being begged, or what's engaged in question begging, essentially. So yeah, I mean, this is the first move. It's just all that from there.
Yeah, that's the first move, and I think this has got to be the first episode. I think we should do a few more of these and kind of go through with ourselves and listeners and really get a basis for where philosophy came from.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. When you suggested it, I was like, oh, this is going to be excellent, especially we're going to sit down with it. We're going to look at the fragments. We're going to reason it out ourselves. It's just something that I think is really worth your time. You know, you can, because I mean, you go and you read philosophy, you really need to sit down with passages. But, you know, when you approach Aristotle or something, how do you do that? It's enormous books. The work's done for you with the pre-Socratics. They give you little fragments. So we just sit down and think about them. It's going to be great.
Awesome. Well, with that, I think we got to end today's episode. You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show, and we'll see you all next week.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Good morning. It's Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, here in the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1 in Burnaby. We just danced our way awake with Soul Makassa.
Yeah, I'm a young black man who uses art to champion and celebrate blackness, as well as creating art that showcases black men as comprehensive, emotionally intelligent human beings.
Right now, we are going to hear a spoken word rap piece by slam poetry winner JB, the First Lady. That is Lady Johnny Proby singing Don't Quit, and here at Speak Up, we do not quit. Love, laughter, argument, and encouragement. The words are too few for the essence of you. And it shows just one of the ways that you can take feelings of pain and transform them to love and recognition. Today, we're exploring senior issues through digital media and the creative arts. My guests are Leslie Riemann, the director of the 411 Center, and Joel Flynn from Podstream. This is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, welcoming you to the Friday Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon What You've Heard show. We have conversations about social issues, culture, and creative arts events, potent samplings about special months like Health Month, Black History Month, Women's Month, Nutrition Month, and more. See you Friday at 10 a.m.
Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.